Cut the music. Cut the music.
I think I got my swagger back. Oh, oh, oh.
Spectacular group of men. You go find them. You throw your arms around them. You give them a big kiss on the mouth if you're a girl.
Oh, the man is out on the field. He's going to go into the end zone.
There goes Davis.
Oh, my God.
Davis is going to run it all the way back. Auburn's going to win the football game. Auburn's going to win the football game.
Like poison. Like rat poison. Are you going to listen to me? Or are you going to listen to these guys?
And welcome to the College Football Country Podcast. That's right. I am back, baby. Back from the dead. It is time to bring back College Football Country. It's only been 4 months. I hope you guys missed me, but I know that you are going to love today's episode. I'm going to try to do one of these a week. I'm looking maybe at dropping them every Wednesday. Tell me what you guys think. How often do you want to hear from me talking college football here in the offseason? There's plenty to get to. I'm going to try to not bite off more than I can chew here in this first episode. I've got so much I want to talk about. So much has happened in the last 4 months in the world of college football. But the NFL draft is here. It is this weekend in Nashville. So I'm going to talk some NFL draft here at the beginning. I'm not worried about who the Panthers are picking at 16, who the Packers are looking at number 12. I'm worried about college football and the impact of this draft on college football. We're going to talk Kyler Murray. I'm going to talk about next year's draft. More so, who could be in the mix for the number one pick next season? Who are going to be the stars of college football this year? So I'll talk about that here at the beginning. In the middle, we'll talk about the college basketball investigation that has now trickled into college football. Marty Blazer, the FBI informant, has some things to say, some allegations that involve Penn State, some other major college football programs. I'll talk about why that's not as big of a deal as it sounds. We'll kind of parse apart that investigation, those allegations, coming up in the middle of the podcast. And then at the end, I've got a little bit of a ranking for you. Top 10 coaching duos in college sports, college football, college basketball, coaching tandems. I tweeted this out about a month ago, and I got a little bit of a firestorm on Twitter. So I'm going to revisit that. I've adjusted the rankings, and my official top 10 will be at the end of this podcast. So I'm sure you guys are going to have plenty to disagree with when it comes to those rankings, the best coaching duos in the country. But for now, I start with the draft. Thursday night in Nashville. Everybody's expecting Kyler Murray's name to be called number one. It's been kind of a foregone conclusion now for the last few months, really ever since Cliff Kingsbury took the job at Arizona, that he was going to take Kyler Murray, his boy, the guy that he has been recruiting since he was a sophomore in high school down there in Texas. Cliff Kingsbury finally gets his guy in Kyler Murray to go number one. Now, I was all in on Kyler Murray. If you've been listening to the podcast, you know how much I love Kyler Murray. I am Kyler Murray bandwagon leader. I was driving the engine. I called it before the season began. He would win the Heisman. I said he was going to turn down the Major League Baseball draft or to actually go play Major League Baseball. He was drafted. I said he was going to turn down the money. He was going to come to the NFL. He was going to be the glory quarterback, the greatest thing since Bo Jackson, the two sports star. He was going to spurn baseball. And that's what he did. And now he's here with a chance to be the number one pick. All of a sudden, I'm kind of cooling a little bit on Kyler Murray as the potential number one pick, and I'll tell you why. First of all, I'm less certain right now that the instability in Arizona is going to ruin Kyler Murray. I think that could be a really big problem for him. He's going into an organization with a GM who is now going to draft back-to-back quarterbacks and back-to-back drafts. He's got a coach who never could have even win in college, even with Pat Mahomes. He was 13-15 with Pat Mahomes. He never had the number one offense in the Big 12, even with the best quarterback we've probably seen in 10 years coming through college football, apparently, now that we've seen him win an MVP in the NFL, and a first-time head coach. I worry about that. I worry about the Cardinals' offensive line. I know that Kyler Murray has been criticized as a guy who's 5'9". I don't really care about the height in most situations because I think that your ability to get outside the pocket to make throws off platform, they like to say, is honestly more important. When you're taking snaps 5 yards deep, I don't really care how tall you are. Height mattered a lot more when quarterbacks were taking 3-step drops and throwing quick slants. We were running the ball out of the I formation every other play. It's just different now. Height isn't that important. And Lincoln Riley has proven now with Kyler Murray. He did it with Baker, who was a little bit bigger than Kyler, but still 6 feet tall. Height's not really of an importance. However, having said that, what the NFL has started to do, And I've been listening to a lot of really smart people talk about this recently. Daniel Jeremiah from NFL Network has talked about this at length. Lewis Riddick talked about this a lot. If you didn't listen to Lewis Riddick on the Mina Kimes podcast last week, it's fantastic. Once you're done listening to this, go download that podcast because he spit the truth on really the future of football and the importance of different positions as it pertains to the draft, talking about interior rush. And as the NFL starts to gear more towards creating pressure up the middle, that's going to force Kyler Murray outside the pocket where he can succeed, but he's got to be able to make throws from in the pocket as well in the gun. I think he can make those throws out of the pocket, but at only 200 pounds, how much physical wear and tear can he take? The NFL has not looked kindly on mobile quarterbacks that don't have 230 plus pound frames. Cam Newton has survived for this long because he is an absolute freak of nature that is built like a tight end. Robert Griffin III did not succeed long term in the NFL because his body fell apart. I don't know how much Lamar Jackson's going to be able to succeed long term as long as he's going to run the ball as much as he did. I also watched Michael Vick, who was a tremendous runner for a long time, was not a great passer. It was a career 54% passer. It is not great. Succeeds specifically because of his legs, but even his body started to break down when he came back in Philadelphia. He was a threat as a runner, but he was not as dominant of a runner. So we've seen these guys in the league. They struggle to hold up over the long term in their career, over the long term in their career by being a runner. So I'm worried about Kyler Murray. Is that running ability going to translate at 200 pounds? Sure, it might for a year or two, but I'm actually a little nervous about that over the long haul. So those are some big questions about Kyler Murray. I'm mostly concerned about the instability. And going back to what he said in January and February, when he made the rounds at Radio Row, when he talked to Dan Patrick, when he talked to CBS and SiriusXM, and you know, the Dan Patrick interview was the one that got the most attention, was I think this guy's being kind of forced to play football. If you read, there's a fantastic story by Robert Klemko in Sports Illustrated recently about just the path that his dad took, where his dad was kind of felt abandoned by baseball. He felt like he could have been a dual threat quarterback as well, but because the NFL hadn't really adopted, you know, African-American quarterbacks and dual threat quarterbacks, he felt like he missed his chance and he was kind of the right player in the wrong time. It feels like he's trying to live his dream a little bit through Kyler Murray. Kyler Murray did not convince me at all in the interviews, especially the one with Dan Patrick, that he truly wanted to play football. And, you know, I have a hard time buying a week after that interview when he releases a statement announcing that he is moving on from baseball and he is fully committed, 100% committed to the passion of the NFL. No, he's not. That statement was a statement written by a public relations staff to ensure any NFL team or to try to make them feel comfortable drafting a guy who could, at the drop of a hat, if things aren't working out, go play Major League Baseball. I mean, that's what that was. That's what that was about. I don't think, and I don't blame Kyler Murray for being torn. I don't blame him at all for really just wrenching with this decision for the better part of, you know, the last year. When you are that talented in two sports, when you have multiple passions, you should be able to make that choice for yourself. And unfortunately, he had to pick one or the other. He was not able to play both. No NFL team was going to allow him to play baseball, certainly not as a quarterback. And really at any position these days, it feels like the Deion Sanders and Bo Jacksons of the world are never going to happen again. So for Kyler Murray at quarterback, it was one or the other. It was either go to the NFL, be a quarterback, or go try to be an outfielder in Major League Baseball. Economically speaking, the right choice was to go be a quarterback. For the money, absolutely the right choice was to go play quarterback. Short term, he could have gotten a payday from the A's. They would have given him that bonus. They would have broken some rules to give him more than just the $5 million that he signed as the number 9 pick. But on average, the first round quarterbacks make more money in their career than top 10 picks in Major League Baseball at position players, not pitchers, but field players in baseball. So financially speaking, he made the right decision. As a guy who truly believes in following your passion and in following what you care the most about, Kyler Murray should have the option to play baseball if he wanted to, but it felt like he had to release a statement saying, no, I'm fully committed to football. I love the game. I want to pursue this. This is my dream. I'm sorry, but I watched the guy a week before that be completely lost, completely struggle with even answering basic questions about where his true passions lie, whether it was football or baseball. I don't believe that in a week, all of a sudden, your passions are completely changed. You are completely sold and you are moving on from one sport to put it away forever and for good. I think if things don't work out in Arizona, I think that he very well could go play baseball in 3 years. And if you're Arizona, I don't know that you're willing to take that risk. Granted, if things don't work out, he's probably not going to be a Cardinal either way. I do get that part of the argument. Well, why do you care if he struggles with you in Arizona? Why do you care if he's an outfielder or if he's playing quarterback for some other team in the league? If he's no good, he's no good. You busted on the pick anyway. But you have Josh Rosen. And Josh Rosen, in the last 4 years, Daniel Jeremiah's quarterback rankings have him third. Has him as the third highest rated quarterback in the last four drafts. You know, ahead of guys like Baker Mayfield, ahead of guys like Jared Goff, ahead of Lamar Jackson, like guys who have had success, made playoff appearances, been to a Super Bowl in Jared Goff already, rookies of the year. He has graded Josh Rosen higher. And just because Josh Rosen went to a system in Arizona where they had a first-time head coach, where they fire their offensive coordinator in week five of the season, very early on in the season, before they even make it halfway, where he was sacked 45 times. That was the fourth most of any rookie quarterback in the last 20 years, where he was playing behind the worst offensive line in the NFL, the 32nd ranked offensive line. You had 11 different guys start at least or play at least 100 snaps on the O-line. There was no continuity for Josh Rosen. I wouldn't move on from that guy. I would go take Nick Bosa from Ohio State. Who I think could be a dominant pass rusher for the next 8 to 10 years. He's built very similar to his brother. It's easy to make that comparison, but they're almost identical guys. Joey Bosa is going to be an all-pro for basically a decade. Nick Bosa feels like he could be that exact same thing. If you're Arizona, you've got the quarterback. You don't need to trade him in basically exchange for what will probably be a second or a third round pick, wasting on a top 10 pick already a year in. It just doesn't happen. No quarterback has gone in the top 10 of a draft and been traded within a year in the history of the NFL, and it shouldn't happen now. So I've actually backed off my Kyler Murray stance. I think Kyler Murray in the right system with a good offensive line, where he could play behind a veteran for a year and then get his chance, I'm all on board with that. That team is the New York Giants. This isn't going to happen, so I'm not going to waste a ton of breath talking about it. But if the New York Giants were able to draft Kyler, if Arizona passes on him, if Oakland somehow passes on him, and I don't hate the idea of him in Oakland, although the Gruden-Mayock right now dynamic scares me off a little bit. But if they pass on him and Murray is available at six, if this somehow happens, the unthinkable happens and Murray is available at six, I think he would be great in New York. I think they could play Eli Manning for a year, even 12 weeks of this season. If the season is completely thrown away by that point, if it's a lost cause, you've got a month left, throw Kyler Murray in there. But at the very least, you've got him for year two. You now have not only Kyler Murray, but Saquon Barkley in the same backfield, Evan Ingram, who I think is going to be a future star at tight end. He's already shown flashes as a receiving tight end. He's going to be great. You've got Sterling Shepard. I know that you lost out on Odell Beckham. You traded Odell Beckham, but that's fine. Murray and Barkley in a backfield, to me, feels like a futuristic offense, an unstoppable tandem in that backfield. I mean, people have called Kyler Murray basically a Barry Sanders-type player with an arm. If that's the case, why not pair him with Saquon Barkley, who feels like the second coming of Emmitt Smith? I mean, I just think it's an incredible pairing that you could have in New York. It won't happen. So that's my two-minute rant on why Kyler Murray would be a great New York Giant, but he's probably going to be a Cardinal, and I do think that that is a bit of a mistake. The question now is, with Oklahoma, as it pertains to Oklahoma, could Jalen Hurts be the third straight Sooner to win a Heisman? And could he even remotely enter the conversation as a first-round pick? Remember, nobody was talking about Kyler Murray a year ago as the number one pick. And I know that Kyler was the number one quarterback out of high school. He had more accolades than Jalen Hurts, who was a four-star athlete. He was never really primed to be the quarterback of the future at Alabama. It just kind of turned out to be that way when he was a freshman and kind of took over that starting job. But Kyler Murray seemed destined for greatness as a high schooler, unlike Jalen Hurts. So the accolades definitely fall in Murray's favor. However, I do think that Jalen Hurts could have a tremendous year at Oklahoma. You know, a year ago, I talked about Kyler being a Heisman favorite, a guy that I picked to win the Heisman because he's going into a system that just churns out ultra-productive college quarterbacks. Lincoln Riley has now done this time and time again. They've had back-to-back years where they've led the nation in total offense. They've led the nation in yards per play. I don't see why Oklahoma can't do that this year. The difference with this Oklahoma team, they don't have a D.D. Westbrook. They don't have a Mark Andrews. They're not going to have that dominant receiver. They're not going to have Marquise Hollywood Brown. So they're losing some of those guys at receiver. But they do have CeeDee Lamb. And more importantly, in the backfield, they are loaded with Trey Sermon and Kennedy Brooks. They combined for 2,000 yards last season after Rodney Anderson went down early in the year. This Oklahoma backfield is going to be ridiculous. This is going to be the best backfield in college football. It's going to be a three-headed attack. They're going to run for probably close to 250, 300 yards a game. Lincoln Riley's one of his best traits is his ability to tailor his offense to the personnel. They're not an offense that's going to, this is the system, you're going to run the system, you're going to do it my way, and that's it. Lincoln Riley is smart enough to know, I've got to build an offense that, yeah, I've got my core beliefs, I've got my philosophy, but if I've got a guy who's a better runner than a passer, or I've got a guy who throws it better out of play action or runs from under center, or I have a personnel where I would be better out of two tight end sets or three wides, it doesn't matter. He puts the best 11 players on the field, and he puts them in position to succeed. Jalen Hurts is a good, not great passer, but he takes ultra care of the football. He's incredibly efficient, and that's not something you could say about Kyler Murray when he was at Texas A&M. As a freshman at Texas A&M, with admittedly much less talent around him than Jalen Hurts ever had at Alabama, Murray threw 5 touchdowns and 7 interceptions. Split time with Kyle Allen, threw 59% completion. Jalen Hurts was better than that every step of the way at Alabama. Now, he's not a better player. He's not physically a better quarterback than Kyler Murray. He doesn't have as good of an arm. He's not as dynamic of an athlete. Good runner, but doesn't have the quick twitch, the ability to make you miss like Kyler Murray. But Hurts completed 70% of his passes last year in mop-up duty. He was about 62% in his first 2 years at Alabama when he was the starter. So that's already better than Murray. And his touchdown-to-interception ratio is ridiculous, 48-17. Jalen Hurts, as long as he takes care of the ball, Oklahoma's going to win a ton of games next year because they're not going to turn the ball over, and they're going to win by running. They're going to control the clock. They're going to play at a fast tempo, but doing it by running the football, they're going to remind me of what the best Gus Malzahn teams have been. The best, most dominant Gus Malzahn teams have been teams that have run the football at will, at absolute will. That's what Auburn did in 2013 when Nick Marshall was at quarterback. It's what they did, of course, when Cam Newton was under center in 2010. I think that that's what Oklahoma's going to look like this year. So Jalen Hurts isn't going to put up the same sort of passing numbers that Baker Mayfield and Kyler Murray did, where you're touching 4,000-plus yards passing plus another 1,000 yards on the ground. I don't think that you're going to see that from Jalen Hurts. I think you're more realistically going to see about 3,000 to 3,500 yards from Jalen Hurts, and you're going to see another 1,000 yards on the ground. But I think they could have 3 1,000-yard rushers. I think that's the bar I'm setting for Oklahoma. I think Oklahoma could very well win the national title this year. They returned 10 guys on defense that started meaningful games last season. They're going to be much better defensively. That's been the thing that's hurt them now in the last few years. They brought in Alex Grinch as defensive coordinator. Oklahoma's a team to me. I'm going to talk about my post-spring rankings probably next week. I'm going to get into kind of who I'm looking at early on as potential college football playoff teams. But Oklahoma is absolutely on that list, as well as Clemson, as well as Alabama. But I think the Sooners are slowly catching up. They're not on Clemson and Alabama's level defensively, but I think they're learning how they can compete with those teams. They're building through the trenches a little bit better, and I think that the running game of Oklahoma is going to be absolutely dominant next year. So I think that Jalen Hurts could be in New York for the Heisman Trophy ceremony next year. I'm not going to pick him to win it like Kyler Murray and Baker Mayfield, but I do think that he can come close to touching their legacy. I really do. He's not the same player, but I think he could come close. He's not going to be in the conversation, though, for the number one pick in 2020. Kyler Murray is going to be that guy probably this year. Here are my three guys, or actually, I've got five. I got five for you. Five guys I think that are going to be in the conversation for the number one pick next year. Four of them are quarterbacks. Next year's draft class at quarterback is absolutely stacked. This year's class is honestly a joke. I hate bagging on kids too much, but listen, Kyler Murray, there are question marks about Kyler Murray. Dwayne Haskins, to me, is probably the safest quarterback in this draft. And outside of that, there's not a single quarterback that I think is guaranteed to be a starter 3 years from now in the NFL. I really don't. I don't think Daniel Jones is going to be there. I have serious reservations about a guy who struggled at times in the ACC, who threw more picks than touchdowns against UVA and Wake Forest. You had talent at Duke. Yeah, you weren't playing at Georgia. You weren't playing at Alabama or any one of these powerhouse offenses either. But you did have David Cutcliffe, and you weren't able to produce any better than you did at Duke. I haven't seen it from Daniel Jones. I'm not sold on him at all. Drew Lock, same way. He's got incredible arm talent, physical freak, but the production, he doesn't take great care of the football. I'm not sure that he's going to be a guy. He reminds me of another Missouri quarterback. He reminds me of Blaine Gabbert. So that I don't think this quarterback class is great, but next year's class is. And I think there are four guys who are going to be in the mix for the number one pick at quarterback. Tua Tagovailoa makes the most sense. He's got a lot of Russell Wilson in his game. He's a little bit undersized. He's unlike Kyler Murray, though. He is built. He is thick. He feels ready physically to take on to the next level. He can withstand some of the punishment you're going to take at quarterback, even though really most of these guys don't get hit nearly as much as they used to at quarterback anyway. Tua is a guy that can run if he needs to, but makes plays outside the pocket much more so than a guy like Kyler Murray, who when he breaks the pocket, he can beat you with his arm, but he's looking to run. Tua Tagovailoa is a left-handed Russell Wilson. Tremendous leader, incredibly well-raised, great family, incredible head on his shoulders, great leader, humble, all the things that you want from a quarterback. He's not going to cause any distractions. He's not going to, you know, have any questions about his passion for the game. I just think Tua Tagovailoa is a home run guy next season. Teams like Miami are already planning to potentially have him a year from now. The Denver Broncos are going to have a down year. If Joe Flacco doesn't pan out, which he shouldn't, Tua could absolutely be in the mix for Denver. I think that teams are smart to know they don't necessarily need to sign or a veteran experienced quarterback who can win them 6 to 8 games. Let's tank for Tua. I think Tua's right now should be far and away the leader for the number one pick next year. But if he's not, and these things can change, Justin Herbert is absolutely in that mix. Herbert is a bigger bodied guy. He's got a little more Carson Wentz to his game. He's got the ability to run if he needs to, but he's a great passer from within the pocket. Herbert's got the ideal frame. He's the quarterback you dream of. He's the quarterback you dream of with his size at Oregon. It was a bit of a surprise. He didn't go pro because I think he could have been the number one pick this year. I mean, if Arizona didn't have the number one pick, or if a team wanted to trade in for a quarterback, Herbert, to me, could have been, if not number one, a top five pick. He would have been with that Dwayne Haskins mold. I think those two would have battled it out behind Kyler Murray if Kyler does, in fact, go to Arizona. Jake Fromm is an interesting name. All Fromm does is win football games. That guy has been tremendous as a starter. He's lost 3 games in his career at Georgia as a starter in the regular, or 2 in the regular season, then the SEC title last year to Alabama. Jake Fromm has been, from the get-go, like Tua Tagovailoa, built as a tremendous leader, is won over that locker room from the minute he took over the starting job for an injured Jacob Eason 2 years ago. I think that Fromm, as a game manager type quarterback, I think there's some Alex Smith to him. He's not the athlete. He's not quite the runner that Alex Smith was. Remember, Alex Smith was an incredible runner in college. But Jake Fromm does have some of that just efficient style to his game that reminds me of Alex Smith. So I think Fromm is definitely in the mix. If he has a tremendous season, if he carries Georgia to a national championship game, which would be an accomplishment because Georgia's going to be reloading a little bit, especially on offense, I think Jake Fromm could be in the mix for the number one pick. Probably more so going to be that second or third quarterback off the board, but there's a chance. The fourth one is the guy he replaced at Georgia, Jacob Eason. Eason's going to be at Washington this year. I think Washington takes a step forward. I know they lose Miles Gaskin. I know they lose some talent on offense, but Jacob Eason at Washington is an upgrade over Jake Browning. Browning was tremendous in his second year at Washington, that year where they made the college football playoff in 2016, ever since then, or 2017, but ever since then, just never really took a step forward. He was limited downfield. Really, Peterson loves to push the ball down the field, and Jake Browning never offered them that. Jacob Eason does. Jacob Eason has, again, same sort of physical skill set like a Justin Herbert. Big body, 6'5", 215, 220 pounds. He looks like an NFL quarterback. Eason was good as a freshman at Georgia. They won 8 games, lost several close ones. That Georgia team, Eason's freshman year, Kirby Smart's first year, could have easily been a 10 or an 11 win team. Had a couple games gone their way. He led the big win over, of course, Missouri late. Which showed incredible poise and moxie as a freshman. I think Jacob Eason, with a big time year for Washington. If he gets them to the college football playoff, they win 10-11 games, which is absolutely in play. The Pac-12 is not going to be very good this year at all. Probably just as bad as it was last year. Eason could dominate the Pac-12, and I could see Jacob Eason. I could see Jacob Eason being the number one pick in the draft. I very well could. I think he's the dark horse to me. I actually think his ceiling is higher than Jake Fromm, which is weird to say because Fromm replaced Eason and never looked back, and Georgia was totally cool with Jake Fromm being the guy. But when the NFL evaluators start to get in, they start to look at measurables, they start to look at arm talent, they start to throw out all the little buzzwords they like to use, Eason checks those boxes a little bit more than Jake Fromm does, even though Jake Fromm wins a lot of football games and was the call at Georgia a couple years ago. So those are my four quarterbacks. The name to keep an eye on that I like outside of the quarterback world, because you never know. The team that ends up with the number one pick next year could be the Cardinals again, and they could have Kyler Murray on their roster. They could have Josh Rosen, and they don't need a quarterback. Derrick Brown is the defensive tackle at Auburn that could have a standout season. He had 48 tackles a year ago, 10.5 tackles for loss. That number could double this season up to 20. He had 4.5 sacks, 2 pass breakups. He's 335 pounds, 6'5". He is built to plug the middle. He's a tremendous interior pass rusher. Reminds me of Dexter Lawrence, who's coming out of Clemson this year. Reminds me of that kind of build. The thing that I have a concern with him about is the interior pass rushers now, they almost like them in the NFL to be a little bit smaller and quicker. Can you shift into a multiple front and maybe play edge? Can you play like a 5 technique in the NFL? Brown's not really that guy. He's too big to be that guy. He's more of a guy who's going to plug the gaps in the middle and get that rush in that A gap right up the middle in the quarterback, which is what you're looking for in the NFL, but you also want versatility. Ed Oliver is doing that right now. He did that at Houston. He's a guy that's going to be in that mix. Christian Wilkins at Clemson, Rashawn Gary at Michigan. Like, those are the kind of guys who have a little bit more versatility, a little more quickness to their game than Derrick Brown does. But I do love Derrick Brown, his productivity. He's a guy who's probably going to go top 10 next season, no doubt. But I think he could be special at Auburn this season. Not to mention his teammate, Nick Coe, on the other side, who had 14.5 tackles for loss last year. Those two guys, that's going to be the defensive line. It was Clemson this past year. Auburn is going to have, I believe, the best defensive line in football next year. Ohio State's going to be up there as well. Auburn's going to have one of the best defensive lines. I think the best defensive line, certainly in the middle in college football. I think Derrick Brown is going to have a real chance to be, if not the number one pick, certainly in the top 5. All depends on needs. Who knows what's going to happen a year from now? But now we move on. I want to talk about the news that broke on Tuesday coming out of the trial that was originally, this was a college basketball corruption trial. This was a college basketball corruption trial in Manhattan Federal Court on Tuesday. We had CBS's Matt Norlander and Adam Zagoria was there as well, reporting on Marty Blazer. And Marty Blazer, who has now basically become a witness for the FBI, who was placed as an informant to help bring down some of the guys involved in the Adidas corruption scandal. You've got Christian Dawkins, who was a middleman in college basketball that was basically taking money, servicing him as a middleman, taking money from shoe companies, passing them along to families to influence them to go to certain colleges. Marty Blazer was apparently involved in this. He was directly involved as an informant, but also worked with Dawkins for several years. And then, out of nowhere, drops a bomb today, or Tuesday rather, that he also has been doing this in college football. And the report says that Marty Blazer testified that he paid athletes from either multiple hundreds of dollars to several thousands of dollars to family members and associates of the college football athletes so that they would choose him as their financial advisor upon turning pro. This is dating back to over 10 years ago. Now, the specifics that Blazer went into in this testimony were Penn State, North Carolina. Those were the two specific schools that he really talked about. And the Penn State thing is really interesting. He says that he paid the father of former Penn State player Aaron Maben, former defensive end at Penn State back in 2009, paid him $10,000, the father of Aaron Maben, $10,000 to convince him to stay in school. He also says that in regards to North Carolina, Blazer said he paid money to a former first-round pick who was drafted by the Giants in the first round of the 2009 NFL draft. That would be Hakeem Nicks. That was the only Tar Heel that was in the 2009 draft in the first round. So Hakeem Nicks, it would make sense. You connect the dots. Marty Blazer apparently paid money to both Aaron Maben's family and to Hakeem Nicks in exchange for getting their services as a financial advisor once they get to the NFL. Blazer has pleaded guilty to two counts of wire fraud, one count of securities fraud, one count of lying to the SEC. He faces 67 years in prison. So no doubt he's cooperating in this investigation to try to reduce his penalty. But having said that, this guy has no reason to lie. I'll say this on the surface. This guy has no reason to lie about this. These are very specific allegations talking about both Aaron Maben and both Hakeem Nicks. He also mentioned with the Aaron Maben story, and I want to dial in on this because this is where I think it gets interesting. He says that he paid Larry Johnson, well, I should say, a associate of his, a client of his, whose father was on the Penn State staff. That's Larry Johnson. Larry Johnson was a player in the NFL in 2009. His father was an assistant coach at Penn State. So he says that he sat down in a meeting with that assistant coach. We can assume it's Larry Johnson and the family of Aaron Maben and connected those $10,000 payments. If that is the case, this takes on a different level because it involves a coach specifically with the school. Here's the difference right now. I'm going to lay it out for you. The difference between what's corrupt about college basketball and what's corrupt about college football. In college basketball, the agents and the shoe companies specifically know that these guys, these high school kids, are going to be pros within 2 years, probably within a year, period. The miss rate on top 15 basketball players out of high school is significantly lower than the miss rate in college football. Five stars in college football don't make it to the NFL all the time. Or if they do, they make it as sixth, seventh round picks sometimes. You have so many more variables in football. The guarantee that a kid who is a five-star in football that is going to make it to the pros and make you money back if you are an agent or if you are a shoe company, it's a much riskier investment. The guarantee is not there. In basketball, if you're a top 15 recruit, 13 or 14 of those guys are lottery picks. It's just how it happens. There's absolutely occasionally a guy whose stock falls or he gets into trouble off the court and he just doesn't make it as a pro. But even then, those guys, they get overseas and they still end up making lucrative contracts. There's just more opportunity in basketball to go make money than there is in football. If you don't make it in the NFL, your contracts aren't guaranteed. You have to stay for 3 years in college. It becomes much harder for those players to pay back the money and return the investment that a booster, or I shouldn't say booster yet, but a shoe company or an agent is going to make in them. So the agents aren't really getting involved with high school players, okay, in football. They're not really getting involved with high school football players. Now, the shoe companies, there is not to the same volume that there is in basketball. I have seen it firsthand. I've seen shoe companies that host these camps. There are times where you're seeing guys take home ridiculous amounts of gear. They invite these kids to come to these All-American camps or to these All-American games. They're trying to get in with these kids. It is a week-long sales pitch. That's what they're doing. I don't know. I don't believe, and nor have I ever seen money exchanging hands, but there is copious amounts of gear that goes to these kids. And that is absolutely a sales pitch to try to convince them to go. If they don't sign with a school that is partnered with a shoe company, they're at least trying to put the seed in their brain that if they get to the NFL, hey, come sign with us. You were an All-American at our camp back when you were in high school. Come be our guy. That's their way of getting in with football players. But they don't have the money because there are hundreds of football players with the possibility to be drafted or to be first-round picks. When they're 16, 17 years old, they don't have the money to be funneling $100,000 to these kids like they do in basketball, where it's much easier to see that return on your investment. So the shoe companies aren't directly involved in the paying either. The boosters are the ones who are getting involved in football because the boosters in football, and I think there's booster involvement in basketball as well, but the boosters in football, one, you've just got, I think, a much more avid following in football. There's more money in the sport of football. More schools are pouring that money in to the sport. So you have boosters all over the place that are willing to go out of their way and to make these under-the-table payments to players. That's happening. That isn't directly tied. None of what I'm saying here is directly tied to a coaching staff. I think it is much more plausible in football that coaches are not offering up major, major payments to players. Now, when kids are on official visits, we heard this with Texas A&M a year ago. The kid who transferred out of Texas A&M to Arizona, who said that when he was on his visit at A&M, they gave him an extra $500. Have fun tonight. Whatever you do with it, I don't care. Go have fun. That happens. But these major payments, they're not really coming from the teams themselves, because the teams get these kids. The coaches are certainly probably involved in the official visit level, but you're not slipping a kid $100,000. You're not slipping a kid $50,000 on an official visit. I don't believe so. We haven't really heard of that at any point. You do have rogue assistant coaches who have been facilitating payments. John Blake back at North Carolina, he was involved in that with the Marvin Austin situation, several other players at the same time, Robert Quinn. But it's not happening on that scale. It's much more happening at the agent level. It's much more happening at the agent level, trying to convince these guys to go pro. So, for instance, to bring this full circle, Marty Blazer. Marty, there are a ton of guys out there like Marty Blazer. I know a few of them personally. Not that they've been involved in this necessarily, but they've told me the stories of being involved with players who have reached out and made agreements, handshake agreements with agents or financial advisors. That's the key one. Financial advisors, whatever the heck that means, who have said, hey, I'll give you X amount of money now. You pay me that money back when you go pro, and I will be your financial advisor. I know right now you're not getting much. You're just getting a stipend. You get your scholarship. You don't have a lot of spending money. You don't have time to earn your own money. You come from a hard background. I'll help you out right now. I'll hook you up with a car. I'll hook you up with an apartment. We'll give you some clothes, whatever that might be. And then in a year, when you get to the league, hey, be my guy. So really the key for college players is when they hit that sophomore year, when they know that they're now within that 2-year window of going pro, they're going into their junior year, that's when the leeches are out. That's when the financial advisors are coming out and they are trying to find any potential draft guy they can find, any potential draft prospect they can find, they're trying to latch on. That's not on the school. The school absolutely has a responsibility to educate their players, has a responsibility to prepare them and warn them about the dangers and what can happen to the program, to the school, if they're caught. The problem is, it shouldn't really impact the school. That's where this whole thing just devolves into a dark world of moral, what's right, what's wrong, because the school, why should a school like USC, for example, which found out after the fact, Reggie Bush was paid by an agent, they set his parents up in a house, he loses the Heisman Trophy, USC vacates a national championship, and it's a dark mark on the university forever. University didn't really do much. That's what I don't understand. Now, if we were to go back, and I don't expect this to happen. I think Dan Wetzel wrote a column in Yahoo about this as well. If the NCAA were to investigate and find out Larry Johnson did, in fact, help facilitate a payment with Aaron Maben's family, he set up a meeting where Marty Blazer said, I'll give you $10,000. You have to come back to Penn State for an extra year and before you go pro. And then Aaron Maben's family pays back the money afterwards. Larry Johnson's at Ohio State now. It's been 10 years. Larry Johnson is no longer with the program. Aaron Maben's been long gone. Why on earth should the kids who are at Penn State today, they've been through 3 head coaches since then. They've been through Bill O'Brien. They've been through now James Franklin is there following, of course, Joe Paterno. Why should they pay the price now a decade later? I never understand that. It's part of the vicious cycle that happens in college sports where you put these schools on probation. There's no real way to punish these schools, no fair way at least to punish these schools. Yeah, you can vacate wins. Who cares? Vacating wins is the most hollow threat, the most hollow punishment that exists in sports. But if you actually punish the program now, all you're really doing is punishing kids 5-10 years later who had nothing to do with the actual crime. So I don't really believe that this is really up to the schools. As long as they have plausible deniability, which in the Larry Johnson case, he, according to this allegation, was involved. But certainly if the coaches aren't involved and this is just financial advisors running around handing out checks to players, there's not much the schools can do about it. I mean, they can warn the players and they can try and warn them of what can happen. But, I mean, the schools are it's not in their control. So I think this is really a dangerous thing. Whereas in college basketball, it's just entirely different. You've got shoe companies who are partnered directly with the colleges. Adidas is directly tied with Kansas. They're directly tied with Louisville. Nike directly tied with Arizona. Under Armour at Auburn. Like these schools, and I mean, I'm just naming some of the schools that have been named in this investigation, but the schools have an actual real stake in the success of these college basketball programs. One player makes such a large impact every single year at college basketball. Guys who are one and dones, Joel Embiid, Andrew Wiggins, you name it. These guys go to college at Kansas, or they go to college at you know, at Duke or Carolina or any other school. I'm just naming any college where you have a lot of one and dones or these big time players. They go and they make a big impact, and that impacts the bottom line of these schools. The shoe companies. They're going to be involved much more directly with funneling kids to a specific college. So there's a difference, right? Like when you have a shoe company who is involved in getting kids to go to a certain college, to me that's different than an advisor who is already going to a kid who's already out of school and simply saying, hey, I'm going to pay you so you represent me when you're in the NFL. You're not really doing anything that's changing the landscape of college football in most instances. The Aaron Maben one is the one that's a little unique in the sense that you convinced a kid to come back, so it did create a competitive advantage. But if you're not going to be able to police this until 10 years out, who really cares? Where you're creating competitive advantages is in the college basketball world by influencing kids to go to specific schools. That's not fair. That's not fair when you create those advantages. But if you're a financial advisor and you're simply illegally attaching yourself to a player when he's a sophomore at any college in the country so you can work with him when he's a pro, I really don't think that matters. I honestly think that should be legal. I think these players should be able to hire agents who can help pay for their expenses while they're still in college. And by the time they get to the pros, if they make it, by all means, you can pay that agent back. If you don't make it to the pros, well, hey, guess what, agent? You just made a bad investment. That happens. That's life. But you're not creating a competitive advantage inherently by doing that. I think you would obviously have to police this if you're the NCAA and ensuring that schools do not get attached to agents, because then you could end up in a situation, if it's above the table, where schools could have basically these unwritten agreements with agents. Hey, we'll help. We'll work with us. You know, you pay these certain players. You convince them to go play at a certain college. But I think once you've been in college for a year, if you've been in college for a year, you should be able to sign with an agent at that point. And try to clear this up. Get this out in the open sooner so that we don't have to deal with these agents trying to pay these players at an incredibly early age and for it to be somehow legal and it to end up punishing the school years and years later. Just shouldn't happen. So that's the key difference between basketball and football. I want to get that kind of out there because there are differences. And college basketball, I'm glad they're addressing this now. End of the day, most of these players should be compensated anyway. But the key difference between football and basketball is just that. Now it's time for my favorite part of the show. We're going to wrap this up with my best college coaching tandems. And there's been a few changes in the last month here in college basketball. There's been a few in football as well. I have got a list of the top 10. And it is hard. It is really hard to get to 10. It is hard to get to 10 duos in college that where both coaches have like a legitimate track record of long-term success. Maybe I've left one off, and if I have, by all means, you can tweet at me at Josh Parcell. Let me know who you think belongs on this list. But I've got 10 coaches that I or 10 pairs rather, tandems of coaches that I think belong here, and I don't know that I could get much past 10. Even 10 is a bit of a stretch. So my number 10 here, I'll go 10 through 1. Number 10 is Chris Peterson and Mike Hopkins at Washington. Mike Hopkins has been at Washington for 2 years, was a great assistant at Syracuse. They won the Pac-12 this year in an historically bad year for the Pac-12, and they made the second round of the NCAA tournament. That's it. I mean, that's it for Mike Hopkins. He's a coach on the rise. He could very well be the next coach at Syracuse in a few years, and Jim Boeheim steps down. But he barely has anything to his resume. I'll give him the conference championship this year, but it was a terrible year for the Pac-12. It was the worst year they've had probably in 2 decades. Chris Peterson absolutely puts them on this list. He's won the Pac-12 twice, made the playoff a couple years ago. He's won 139 games. He's lost 33. Peterson is one of the 8 best coaches in college football. He belongs on this list, and he drags Mike Hopkins right behind him. So they make number 10. I got blown up by Washington fans on Twitter who thought that they should be number 1. That's ridiculous. Mike Hopkins is a fine coach. I like him. He seems like he's going to do well. He's made one NCAA tournament and he won one game. I'm not putting you any higher than that. Now, number 9. This is another list where neither coach has experienced a ton of postseason success. But I like where they're headed. And that's Scott Frost and Fred Hoiberg. Scott Frost and Fred Hoiberg at number 9. Hoiberg was 155 and 56 at Iowa State. He made a Sweet 16. That's more than Mike Hopkins can say. He made it to the NBA, got a raw deal in Chicago, works for one of the most dysfunctional front offices in the NBA. He's back at Nebraska now, and a perfect fit for him. He succeeded at Iowa State, which is off the beaten path, flyover states. You're going to have to recruit transfers. I think Hoiberg's going to do a great job there getting in talent at Nebraska, a program with no history of success in college basketball. So I do like that hire there, and he got paid ridiculous money too. But Scott Frost is a coach who went obviously 13-0 at Central Florida in 2017. We remember that year well. Laid the groundwork for another run where UCF was again dominant this season, making that undefeated run again through the regular season. Mackenzie Milton could have been a Heisman finalist if he didn't suffer the leg injury in the last game in the conference championship game. But then Scott Frost goes 4-8 in year one at Nebraska. Now, that record, obviously not great. But you dig a little deeper, and that Nebraska team should have been a 7 or an 8 win team, which would have been a huge step forward in year one. So I think that Frost, because he lost Martinez to an injury early on, they lost a couple games they shouldn't have because they didn't have another quarterback on the roster. That's a unique situation. I think Frost is going to win big at Nebraska. I do. I think Frost is going to quickly bring Nebraska up to the level of Wisconsin, up past the level of Iowa. I think Nebraska is going to be right there, 1-1A with Wisconsin in the Big Ten West. Very soon, they're going to be a top 20 program year in and year out. He is a dynamic coach. He does it the right way. Tremendous leader. Innovative offensive mind. Frost, to me, right there. So, Chris Peterson, better coach than Scott Frost. Certainly more accomplished. But Fred Hoiberg runs circles around Mike Hopkins right now. And I don't think Frost is that far off from Chris Peterson. All right, they both were really, really good at a mid-major school, if you will, in college football. Frost has the undefeated season to his name. Peterson has the runs at Boise State, the win over Oklahoma in the Fiesta Bowl back in 07. I think Frost is basically this decade's Chris Peterson, and Hoiberg is so much further ahead than Mike Hopkins at this point. That's why I give them the nod over the Washington guys right now. Number 8. This one is going to be, I think it's going to irritate a few people, but I'm going to go with Matt Painter and Jeff Brohm. Jeff Brohm was 30-10 at Western Kentucky. He's only 13-13 at Purdue. Last season at Purdue did not end well after the big win over Ohio State. They limped kind of to the finish. But I think Brohm, first of all, turned down several jobs this season, turned down the Louisville job, could very easily have gone and taken that gig. They offered him a lot of money to come home, turned it down. Brohm is building something at Purdue that's going to be good. Purdue, they're not going to be Nebraska good, but I think Purdue is going to be Iowa good. I think they will be a top 20 to 25 team just about every season, and I'm on board with that at Purdue. That is thriving at Purdue. Brohm should absolutely be in the mix for major head coaching openings really every single season until he decides to go. If he wants to stick it out at Purdue and build something, he can. But I think eventually somebody's going to snap him up. I think a big school is going to come that he won't be able to resist. An SEC school, if Ed Orgeron doesn't work out at LSU in the next few years, don't be surprised if Jeff Brohm's name comes into that mix. If Clay Helton finally is let go at USC, I think Brohm's in the mix at USC. Too many jobs are going to come open. I think Brohm eventually will leave. Matt Painter has made five Sweet 16s. He's won 3 Big Ten titles at Purdue. Probably one of the most underrated coaches in college basketball. I love what he's done. He got them to the Elite Eight this season with Carson Edwards, Purdue basketball. Outside of Michigan and Michigan State, probably the best program in the Big Ten right now. So they belong in that top 15 mix as a program in college hoops. Matt Painter is why. So I got them number 8. Number 7, John Calipari and Mark Stoops. Now, Calipari carries them. He is dragging Mark Stoops into this top 10. Cal's made 6 Final Fours, 4 at Kentucky. He had the 2 vacated before this at UMass and Memphis. He's made won the national championship in 2012, 6 SEC championships. I don't have to tell you how good of a coach John Calipari is. He's one of the 3 or 4 best in college basketball. I'm not here to split hairs about who's the top 3, but Calipari is absolutely in that conversation. And he's the best recruiter in the country. Mark Stoops, now he did not top 7 wins until 2018. They won 10 games in 2018, SEC Coach of the Year. Benny Snell was a tremendous running back, all SEC. Josh Allen's going to be a top five pick in the NFL draft. All of a sudden, Kentucky football is relevant, and that's because of Mark Stoops. And it's a testament to Kentucky for being patient in letting Stoops build something at Kentucky over time. That's not a program where you're going to turn it around in 2 or 3 years. It's not a conference where you're going to turn it around in 2 or 3 years. Making Kentucky football relevant is enough to get you on this list. I put him just ahead of Brohm for that reason. A 10-win season at Kentucky, that's better than anything Brohm has accomplished at Purdue. So I give him the nod over Brohm, and of course John Calipari ahead of Matt Painter at this point. So they go number 7. Number 6, and I left them off of my first list. But I'm going Roy Williams and Mack Brown. Roy Williams and Mack Brown, because Roy has won 3 national titles, 9 Final Fours, 9 ACC regular season titles, a handful of ACC tournaments as well. That gets you ahead of John Calipari on my list. I think Roy is a better coach than Calipari. He's done more with less. Mack Brown, he does have the national championship, and North Carolina fans will absolutely remind you of that any chance they get. North Carolina fans act like Mack Brown actually won the national title at Chapel Hill. They literally photoshopped a picture of him on the Jumbotron at the spring game, just completely took out all the Texas gear, just got a tight close shot of his face holding the trophy, making it look like he won the national title at Carolina. That's ridiculous. He was fired at Texas, didn't win 10 games any of his last 4 years, losing record 1 year, couldn't find a quarterback, couldn't develop a quarterback in the end of his run at Texas. He's got to prove to me that he can still coach in 2019, but does have the resume, and Roy alone I think gets them onto this list ahead of the other guys that I've just listed. So I've got Carolina number 6 with Roy and Mack Brown. Number 5, Mike Bray and Brian Kelly. Now Mike Bray, I was actually surprised, has only made the Elite 8 twice. Only 2 Elite 8 runs, both coming while they were a member of the ACC. Never did it at the Big East. Never made it past the Sweet 16 in his first 10 years as a coach when they were in the Big East, but he's done it twice now. Won the ACC tournament a handful of years ago, tied for a regular season title as well. So I do think that Notre Dame, despite a down year this past season in basketball, the fact that they have remained as relevant as they have in the ACC while fighting against Carolina, Duke, Syracuse as well, Louisville. I love what Bray has done. I think he is, again, one of the most underrated coaches in college basketball. Brian Kelly, meanwhile, made a national championship at Notre Dame, 12-1 a year ago, a handful of 10-win seasons. He has been the best coach at Notre Dame since Lou Holtz. He belongs at number 5 on this list. Brian Kelly gets a bit of a bad rap sometimes at Notre Dame. That's one of the hardest jobs to win consistently in college football. I don't care what you say. He's been able to do it, and all the while has churned out about a dozen studs into the NFL. He has been an excellent developer of talent at Notre Dame. Doesn't get enough credit for that. I've got them at number 5. Number 4, Texas A&M. Jimbo Fisher and Buzz Williams. Now, Buzz Williams doesn't have the national accolades. He hasn't made a Final Four. No national championship, of course. Only 1 Elite 8. But he is the best rebuilder in college basketball right now. I mean, him, Chris Beard, of course, did it at Texas Tech and got them to a national championship game this season. But what Buzz Williams has done in rebuilding Virginia Tech, he did it at Marquette as well. It is unparalleled, I believe, to prove that he's been able to do that at multiple stops. I think he's going to do it at Texas A&M to take Virginia Tech from a 2-win team in the ACC in his first year to the Sweet 16 just 4 years later is a ridiculous accomplishment. And he's going to do something similar at A&M. And Jimbo Fisher has a national title. He's got the contract that's going to have to, he's going to have to back it up, $75 million, 3 ACC championships at Florida State. Don't love the way it ended at Florida State, and that makes me a little nervous. How is that he going to handle the exposure at A&M, the pressure that's going to come with that A&M job if they do get back to the top, if they become a top 10 team? But I think they're on their way. He's a tremendous coach, one of only 4 coaches active, that's, or actually 3 now, with between Saban, oh, 4, Saban, because Mack Brown is now active again. So Saban, Dabo Swinney, Jimbo Fisher, Mack Brown, only active coaches with a national championship. So Jimbo belongs at near the top of this list, and I think Buzz Williams, better coach than Mike Bray, better coach than, equal coach to Matt Painter, and he's a better coach than I think Fred Hoiberg at this point too. So I've got them at number 4. Top 3 here, this is where it gets really, really tough. I've got Duke number 3. Coach K, 5 national championships. That's ahead of Roy Williams, although I do think Roy's a better coach, but the accomplishments speak for themselves. 5 national titles, 12 Final Fours, 12 ACC championships. Coach K is the most accomplished coach in college basketball. I don't think he's the best, but he is the most accomplished coach in college basketball. And David Cutcliffe has a near 500 record at Duke, which is like winning 10 games a year at basically another school in the country. Cutcliffe is a tremendous coach. He does more with less than just about anybody else. He took over a program that won basically between 0 and 3 games every year for 20 years between him and Spurrier. And Cutcliffe has made them relevant. They made an ACC championship game a few years ago. Cutcliffe is a great coach. Now, I don't think that he is all some sort of quarterback whisperer that he gets. I mean, I think he's a great quarterback coach, but people point back to his relationship with the Mannings as if he just sprinkles pixie dust on all of his quarterbacks and turns them into NFL guys. He hasn't really had an NFL quarterback since the Mannings. He had Peyton and Eli. He had Thaddeus Lewis, who had a cup of coffee in the NFL. Daniel Jones now is going to have a shot, but that's about it. So I do think that there's a little bit of a overreaction to Cutcliffe as a quarterback whisperer. I still think they're number three. Number two, I've got Jim Harbaugh and I've got John Beilein. Now, people want to hate on Harbaugh. He's 38-14 at Michigan, 3 10-win seasons. They tied for the Big Ten East title last season. They were a half yard away of winning the Big Ten East in his first year, losing that overtime game to Ohio State. This team, while they have underachieved relative to expectations at Michigan, the expectations were the problem. The production has been great. Michigan has been one of the 7 or 8 best teams in college football perennially since he's gotten there. And I think they're only going to be better this season with Shea Patterson under center again, or whoever could end up being that quarterback. So I think Michigan is going to be very good again. And I think Jim Harbaugh belongs in the class of the top 5 or 6 coaches in college football. I don't care what anybody says. The biggest problem has become he rubbed some people the wrong way with his larger-than-life personality, and now there is almost a sense that the media, I believe, is rooting for him to fail, and a lot of fans are rooting for him to fail. So they're going to pick apart any shortcomings that they see and, I think, make them so much of a big deal, blow them completely out of the water, when in reality, Jim Harbaugh is better than 98% of the other coaches in the country, bar none. So John Beilein at Michigan, undeniable. 2 Big Ten titles, 2 Final Fours, made it to a couple national championship games, lost them both. Beilein has built a force at Michigan. If they didn't lose so many guys, they've actually lost a bunch of key guys off of this year's team that I thought were going to come back. Michigan could have been a top 3 team next season. Instead, it might be a bit of a rebuild there for the Wolverines, but Beilein has been so good at Michigan now for so long. He was good going back to West Virginia as well. I think Harbaugh and Beilein, it's hard to beat that duo, but the team that beats them is the team in their same state. That's Tom Izzo and that's Mark D'Antonio. Mark D'Antonio made a college football playoff a couple years ago with the Spartans in the same conference as Ohio State, as Penn State, as Michigan. He's made Michigan State as good as any of those programs. Ohio State probably gets the nod there. Certainly they've won more games than Michigan State in the last 7 or 8 years since Urban Meyer was there in that run, but Michigan State is nipping on their heels. That is a huge accomplishment in a school that doesn't have the history or the tradition of some of the others in the Big Ten. D'Antonio is, for my money, one of the top 6 coaches in the country, and Tom Izzo is in the exact same boat, probably one of the top 3 or 4. He's been tremendous in March forever, 9 Final Fours, national championship game, 9 conference titles in the Big Ten, made that Final Four this season. Those two, you've got 2 guys who both belong in the top 6 of their respective sports. I think only Michigan State and Michigan can say that. They're the only 2 programs in college athletics that can say, we've got one of the 6 best coaches in football and basketball. Those are the 1 and 2. Michigan and Michigan State have the best tandem. Now, if you want to completely outweigh what Coach K has done or what Roy Williams has done, be my guest. Alabama. Alabama didn't make this list. Nate Oates was great at Buffalo. He's got to prove it at Alabama. He's got to prove it at the next level for me to put him on this list. I know you're going to say, oh, but what? But you have Scott Frost on this list. Proving it at Buffalo and getting to an NCAA tournament is not the same as going undefeated at UCF and winning a Peach Bowl against Florida State. But Auburn. So entirely different to me. And Scott Frost, I think, has proven a little bit more at this point than Nate Oates. Nick Saban's great, but I need to see both. I need to see both of you accomplish something a little bit more at a higher level than what Nate Oates did at Buffalo. Nate Oates would probably, and Saban would probably be my 11, but I don't have him on the list. And I'm not trying to be a hot take guy here. I just genuinely think that I need to see something from both coaches at a high level for me to put you on this list as a best duo. Best coach in college football, bar none, is Nick Saban. Dabo Swinney, Brad Brownell has next to no accomplishments. And I mean, he's a nice guy. I've met him a few times. He good enough coach. He's done okay at Clemson. Can't make the NCAA tournament back-to-back years. I mean, that's just not good enough for me compared to the other coaches on this list. So Dabo Swinney and Nick Saban, you're great coaches. You don't belong on this list for the best coaching tandem. So there you go. That's my list. Number one, Michigan State. Number two, Michigan. Three, Duke. You can see the rest or if you want to listen back. But that is going to do it for the show. How about that? Did it in right at an hour. You guys, I'm so happy to be back. Make sure you download and subscribe to the podcast. Please drop a rating and review. They help me out a lot. And remember, we're going to bring back the game here. Your favorite college football player, your favorite name. When you leave your review, just when it asks for your name, think of the most random, ridiculous name you can think of, the stupidest, craziest name, and make that your name in the review. I don't care. I don't need to know that John from Kentucky thinks that the podcast is 4 stars. I want to know that Tim Biakabatuka listens to the podcast. That's what I want. So drop those names. I want Kenyon Rambo. I want Oz Hakim. I want you guys in the podcast review. So leave me a review, leave me a rating, and make sure to tell your friends to subscribe. The podcast is back. We're going to be doing this hopefully every week throughout the summer. We're talking college football, taking you all the way up until August. I'm excited. I'm pumped. I hope you guys are too. We'll be back next week, hopefully on Wednesday. I'll recap the NFL draft, and we'll get into some post-spring rankings as well. If there's anything you want me to get into, don't hesitate to reach out on Twitter, @JoshParcell, and let me know. This has been a great show, guys. I'm so excited to be back, and I'll see you next week.